Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
The 15th Convention of the Alaska Federation of Natives marked the 10th anniversary of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Over 600 delegates convened for the three-day event in mid-December 1981, held in the ballroom of a plush Anchorage hotel. Banners decorated the perimeter of the room, bearing the name of each Native regional profit and nonprofit corporation, and the words for hello in the language of the area. For the first time in many years, all corporations could participate in this display, for all 12 in-state regional profit corporations had joined the Alaska Federation of Natives. It was a time of unity and of reflection. Among the panels on land claims history, looking back and looking ahead, presentations on various organizations, there were speeches on the need to continue working together to protect those rights gained by law and to build upon the unity and energy of the convention. On the afternoon of December 16, Chief Andrew Isaac came to the podium, the 83-year-old traditional chief of the Tanana Chiefs. Wearing a dentalium shell necklace and beaded moosehide jacket marking his status, Chief Andrew Isaac delivered this message.
How many people leaving by an ocean and every place you leaving by face? You got the right to fight about. What's the idea? Commercial fishing. You want people move away to buy commercial license. They don't want you to put fish wheel. You don't want to put your fish net. I think that's foolish. My way this way. You people, you live in by faith. Law should let you to have a faith to get enough. Support your family, support yourself, support your village. This is the one thing I want these people sitting around this chair and sitting going to the big business place. That's the one they should put up. You people who live in by game. Let the government, touch the government, tell government to put the law down in our sight, us, Indian. You young generation, you learn education, you just pass. White man, where are you going? You don't care much in you, Indian. I think that's wrong. You have to trust you, Indian. You have to take care of you, Indian. That's why they vote for you. Look at here, pass some kind of cart, the sign. That many people, poor people, support you to go in a business place. Get you big payroll check every month, every week. What's the idea? The people support me that don't trust the people. I don't think that's right. I want you people to join together. Don't you think you different tribe? You same Indian. So long your name's Indian, you Indian. So long, United States, American, American, just one. Why don't you people feel that way yourself? You blonde Alaska. I born in Alaska, raised in Alaska, spent 83 years in Alaska. Ever since last year, My boys and Taranaw Chief and Doyoung and even AFN, they try to keep me up. I'm appreciated that. My great-grandfather's people never have that happen but me. I really appreciated that. My boys hold me up. Today, I have to pay my light, I have to pay my fuel, I have to pay my wood. I never do that before. World's beginning to change. You think you people, you stand, you're going to do it, Sam? Where's the money? 40 million acres land, the people talk about. I'm Indian, I don't know how did I going to figure it. I don't know where that 40 million acres land been set at. I really don't know. I think whole Alaska, I think that's mine. So this is the way I feel. I'm appreciated to be here to talk to you people. Don't forget one thing. Trust your people, take care of your family. Try to support your home. Try to support your village. That's for sure. The people that I'll vote for. I don't know what they've done to me, I really don't know, but I'll vote anyway. The way I understand, I'm beginning to come and understand, I support them. That's why they stay big office, doing a lot of work. They're doing a lot for his people. Something should be changed now. My boys in Taranaw Chief and Doyoung, even AFM, wrote me a letter at Dart Lake. I not even read it. I'm beginning to get an understand to read it now, just to look. I need the teacher. But Indian, you have to tell me what to do. I tell you. Ways to do a lot of this work. Back in the Indian potlatch, that many people. All chief people. Speech every day. Right here, I just talk loud. Go in Tanacross, sometimes potlatch. You want to hear Indian speech, I'll show you up there. We're in Tanacross. But right here, you guys act like white men, so I have to be like white men. A real thanks for you people. Today beginning the law got it coming in. I got my life tie law. I got my billfold here. My grandfathers wanted to shoot the rabbit. They take their muzzleloader shotgun, go shoot it. They see moose, open the muzzleloader shotgun, go shoot it. Today we can't do that. Even now, according to the law, I take my fish rod and go to fishing. Here comes somebody. You're not going to fish right here. So all that stuff, you guys, young generation, That's the way you going in. That make me worry about you, all young generation. Don't matter what you are. Don't matter what education person you are. You're going to get in a hard time, some minute, some hour. You do. This world is not going to be in joy like this all time. One thing, you guys be careful, for sure. Don't leave little people behind. Trust you, little people. Take care of you, little people. Try to support. Try to knock the law down. You understand to talk English, talk with the government, tell, drop down the law for Indian. I should not take permit in back in 32. If I figured, if I got chance enough to think, I would turn in all some like Canadian Indian. Canadian Indian, they don't need no license. They kill their game any time. That's what we should be. I understand the government people, how they try to do this last time before I coming up, the guy talk. Sounds nice. If the problem laying on that way, real good. For you, young people, for you, young generation, you coming here to let the people to talk you in the business? You writing down. How many times I've been speech here? I never seen not one word of what I say in the word. Never been written down, except last fall. I don't care what treat I get, I still stand up under my chief grandfather's place for you, young generation. So thank you very much to be visit with you guys. Look nice, the young generation. One great thing I learned, God bless you. To be with you, keep you up, keep your business lined up right. They'll help you. One main thing you guys to remember, our Father is God in heaven. He's the man to wake me up and stand up and after I got heart attack. And thank you and God bless you. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andrew Isaac. It's really a humbling experience to be speaking while I'm chairing the convention right after a person who is in his own right a living legend. Like I stated, he is a man of his words, and I think we ought to give him another hand.
Chief Andrew Isaac of Dot Lake is the traditional chief of the Tanana Chiefs Conference. You heard a speech he delivered to the 1981 AFN convention in Anchorage. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson, and you've been listening to Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskans. For someone who's never seen a muskox, how would you describe it?
I guess a hairy bison-looking animal with an extremely beef cow-type face. And of course they have that long guard hairs that hang almost down to the ground and large shoulders. That give them a very, very bulky appearance.
Bulky and imposing, though Dr. Bob White is used to working with these furry brown beasts. He's a professor of zoophysiology at the University of Alaska's Muskox Farm, just 5 miles north of downtown Fairbanks. The farm currently has a dozen muskoxen, ranging from calves to adults.
An adult animal is around about 4.5 to 5.5 foot tall at the shoulder and weighs, big bulls weigh up, maybe over 800 pounds, but on the average 600, 700 pounds for a bull and 500, 600 pounds for an adult cow.
The Fairbanks farm, with its muskoxen bulls and cows and calves, and some moose and reindeer as well, looks from a distance like any other farm, complete with white picket fence, barns, and fields of grain. But there's also a viewing platform outside to let people photograph the herd, and there are regularly scheduled tours for closer inspection of the not-so-wild beasts. This muskox farm is not the only one in Alaska.
There are muskox being domesticated at Unalakleet, a little village, of course, in the mouth of the Yukon River. And they have quite a lot of muskox there, over 100. And, of course, that project is being used to comb the underwool or kiviat from the muskox, and it's being processed and knitted into garments, very, very high quality garments for sale. This is an Eskimo cottage industry. Mm-hmm. The only muskox that are taken for meat are taken in special hunts conducted by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game on both Nunavak Island and Nelson Islands.
So how many herds are there then in the state?
Let's say roughly about eight. There's the big herd on Nunavak Island, which is the mother herd for all of the transplant animals, including the animals we have here and the animals that are being domesticated at Unalakleet. And there are several herds on the North Slope, three or four, and then two herds on the Seward Peninsula. Small herd, quite close to Nome.
Why have a muskox farm here in Fairbanks?
Well, that's a good question. A problem now is that we've got lots of management decisions to make with muskox. The populations that are being transplanted are increasing very rapidly, expanding their ranges, and these ranges happen to be headquartered in the bottoms of river valleys, which are also important sites for material, for construction enterprises such as haul roads or pipeline or access roads, that kind of thing. And muskox tend to be orientate on a river bottom and live there virtually year-round except for a small amount of time, and so they're obviously going to be prone to disturbance by these kinds of development processes. So we have to know a lot more about how to manage them, which means we're going to need to make decisions on when we can get in and move animals, modify their environment, and take animals for, say, products or for food. But that has to be done on a good biological background, and what we're doing is trying to provide just some of that background.
Development has affected the muskox before. Although indigenous to Alaska, the animals became extinct by the 1860s, victims of the bullets of whalers and Eskimo villagers, meat for the Arctic winter. To obtain good data for the experiments conducted by White and his co-workers, experiments related to current threats to survival, the animals must learn to trust the researchers.
What we do is exactly the same thing as the domestication program has done, and that is to obtain animals and at birth and have them affiliated with humans, imprinted on humans rather than imprinted on other muskox, and so they grow up very, very quiet and tame and imprinted on us, and we can do a lot with them.
One of these big furry beasts could think that you're its mom?
That's the way it starts, but I'm sure by the time the animals are more than a year old, they've worked out that we're not mum, but they still have strong affiliations with us. They associate us with the feeding process in particular and with treatment. They obviously look to us for that kind of comfort. So to that extent, I guess, we're mother, but they prefer themselves to us.
What kind of noises do they usually make when they're hungry?
Baby cries. Yeah. Sort of a grunt and a baw and a little bit of everything put together. It's like yeah, something like that.
Well, maybe I think
if we that. Disappear. You know.
And leave me alone with these wild animals?
Wild animals.
There were three baby muskox and calves and a moose calf shuffling around a wire-enclosed pen next to a building with stalls in their feeding room. It was just past 10 p.m., and time for the two graduate students who fed them to mix up the final bottle for the day.
How many times a day do you feed them?
We've dropped it down to three just this weekend, past weekend. So they're, going a little longer is one reason we also feel like they should be hungry now.
Well, what do you feed them?
It's just a milk formula, lamb milk replacer.
So these are considered like puppies?
Yeah. Just little babies.
Two of those calves died recently. The cause is unknown. The remaining calf will be the subject for a variety of experiments at this experimental farm. Dr. Bob White.
Some of the earliest experiments we did were the simple things like how much food does a muskox need to survive a day. We measured their body weight, food intake, feces output, and were able to estimate how much digestible food they needed to survive, how much gross feed they need to survive. And then as they got, it became summertime, we correlated food intake with rate of growth so we could find out how much food was then needed to make the animals grow as well. This kind of experimentation then allows us to set some minimal estimates on the amount of food that these animals would eat in the wild, and this allows us then to make some estimates of, in the long run, of carrying capacity. Second measurements, experiments we did was to look at their changes in body composition. How much fat reserves do they put on? How fat are young calves going into winter, and how fat are yearlings going into winter? Because they have to survive the rigors of winter on a very, very low food intake, and the fat reserves of the animal going into winter more or less set the level on what percentage of that cohort survive and what kind of condition they're like after the end of winter, and therefore what kind of growth they'll make the next summer. So you've got these kind of carryover effects. To measure body composition under live conditions is very difficult. We have to use a special marker that we inject into the animals and look at the way it's distributed in the body, and the marker distributes just in the lean body mass, that's in the muscle, so we can kind of estimate the muscle knowing the body weight. By difference, we've got the amount of fat that's there. It's an indirect method, but about as accurate as we can get at the moment.
Computers are now being used to analyze data in these and other experiments. Experiments that attempt to approximate in an artificial environment conditions in the wild.
We have them sometimes walking on a treadmill, and if they're real excited and huffed up, then you won't get a normal walking value. You'll get the excited animal, and that's not what you'll see out in the wild, so it won't correlate well with that, with what would happen in the wild.
Muskoxen, both wild and human imprinted, have a long evolutionary history.
Moved across the Bering Land Bridge and occupied the extreme aspects of the high Arctic and also down as far as Colorado during various periods between the ice ages. During the ice age, of course, they were remnant populations here in central Alaska and elsewhere. And then they recolonized these islands with the going of the ice and, in fact, have finished their evolutionary process mainly on the high Arctic islands in the very northern parts of Europe and North America. The European musk ox was eliminated, we suspect, nearly 2,000 years ago over there, certainly over 1,000 years ago. But the last animals were shot out in Alaska in the mid-1800s. And following that, there was very strong interest in recolonizing these ranges and getting native animals back onto the range. And so the initial animals were captured on Greenland and brought to New York, cross-country by train to Seattle and then barge to Fairbanks. They arrived here in 1931, about 30 animals, and were used in some feeding experiments here, together with yak and bison and caribou and reindeer. So we certainly had a lot of animals into captivity just 3 miles away from where we are now, back in 1931. But a new administration came in and that program was phased out, and those 33 animals now were moved to Nunavak Island, where they lived until the early 50s, when we had over 500 animals by that time. And the process of moving animals onto onto their native ranges was then started in earnest in the mid-60s. In about 1964, John Teal proposed to the University of Alaska and the Kellogg Foundation that he would like to attempt to domesticate some of these animals from Nunavak Island and use them for a cottage kiviat industry. And so he obtained animals about 30 and brought them here to this farm on Yankovich Road and allowed them to breed at a fairly rapid rate. So he had quite a few animals in 1978 when he moved them then onto what he felt was much more much better muskox range at Unalakleet and closer to the knitting industry.
How did the other herds come to be?
What they did then was a combination of fish and game and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service money, expertise, and know-how was used to capture in the order of 20 to or 15 to about 40 animals at a time and transplant them to various sites in Alaska. What they would do was go out on with their snow machines and round up a herd and use a combination of nets and darting to capture the animals, bring them back to some pens, fly them out of Mokoriak by plane and release them at a site that had been designated for them. There's lots of problems with the early transplants. Animals wandered away rather than keeping together, and so there had to be a balance of young animals that respond best to transplant but tend to not know how to live, and a combination of older animals that are very hard to transport because they resist the process so badly, but of course they have the know-how to keep the herd together.
One of the protective mechanisms used by musk oxen in threatening situations involves a kind of wagon train effect. The older animals forming a protective circle outside, heads and horns facing out, and the younger and less fit animals within. It's a posture they assume often when threatened by herders on snow machines or by their natural predators, wolves. But other than that, the animals are relatively friendly, and researchers can get within 20 or 25 feet of animals in wild herds. The curved horns and imposing stance tends to discourage getting any closer. There are 8 adult musk oxen that graze on one of the fields at the experimental farm. White and I, accompanied by 2 farm workers and a Norwegian tourist, went to visit the herd, approaching slowly. The snorts of angry musk oxen on the other side of birch trees, maybe 30 feet away, but seeming closer. Part of a herd at the University of Alaska's musk ox farm in Fairbanks, one of 8 herds in the state. The survival of these herds depends in part on the work of Bob White and his associates. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson.
We might as well start from this kayak over here. Or the kayak. That's how we would say it in Yupik.
The speaker is Godliva Barr. She's the curator of the Bethel Regional Museum, the Uktarvik Museum. It's a small, two-room log building along one of the main roads in town, just past the cable TV satellite dish and right before the Moravian Church. Once inside the museum building, the visitor is confronted with contemporary masks, baskets, jewelry, and other craft items for sale, followed by a room displaying mostly artifacts, some stuffed animals, and also modern items based on traditional designs, fine examples of current work of the Yupik Eskimo people of the Bethel area.
This kayak was made by...
Godliva Barr.
Originally made by Peter Canuck of Kipnik. And, let's see, it was before the fire, it was, they had it in the river, and I think they were racing with the other people. I'm not too sure how, but anyway, as far as I know, it won, and then they placed it here at the museum. And unfortunately, we had the fire in 1980, and so the cover on the original cover on the kayak got burned. You know, it, and then they had to rip it off before it, you know, it tore the frame of the kayak.
On June 14th, 1980, the museum building was gutted by fire. Many of the artifacts were destroyed or damaged. Volunteers helped to clean and salvage the work. The building was repaired and cases built to display the museum's acquisitions. By October 1980, the museum was open again, thanks in large part to community effort. Take the kayak, for example.
The kayak cover has five pieces, or five skins that were sewn together by the gang from Hooper Bay. David Bunyan was the leader on this crew with the aid of another guy, James Gump, and then all the women had sewn this were from Hooper Bay too. And it took about 6 days to complete the process from soaking the skin up to the fitting and sewing it back together.
Was that a museum project?
Yes, it was. And I helped sew the skin too, and I'm really proud of it.
Godliva is from Nelson Island. That's about 50 miles south of Hooper Bay.
I'm originally from Tununuk, living here now since I got this job.
That's more than a year ago this summer. At first, Godliva was the museum's arts and crafts director and just recently assumed the job of curator. She studied art at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks and also worked in the university museum.
Do you feel that because you're from this area, people come in who might not otherwise come into a museum, is it different having someone from this area running the museum?
Well, to me, you know, I'm from this area. I feel like I know quite a bit of stuff from this area because of my background. And when people come in, you know, I think they're pleased to see somebody sitting behind the desk, you know, running the museum, you know, of this region.
After doing busy.
It's Juktavik Regional Museum. It means of the people, or for the people.
How did this museum get started?
Well, it got started back in 1967, and it was in different locations. One of them, I can remember, one of them was over at the by the court building. And then I don't remember, but someone told me that it used to be over by the Chevron. So it's been wandering around, and now it's this place here. It's been here for quite some time.
How is it funded? How is it supported?
Okay, the city of Bethel support us, and then we do have some grants coming in, you know, other grants too. Mostly the city, you know, provide us, you know, the money and stuff like that. They're the ones that take care of the administrative, you know, the salary and paying for the bills and stuff like that.
So you've got a pretty stable support.
Yeah, we do, fortunately. And then if we have some other things that we want to get into, like workshops and stuff like that, we can apply for some grants from other sources.
There's also some income from the museum shop in the front room.
I got some more ivory here, if you want to see it. Would you like to see some?
I'd like to see
it. Here's some necklaces on here.
That's pretty. We have from ivory carvings to baskets to dolls.
Deesev Jacobson is the arts and crafts director.
In a way, we both take care of it, you know. We work together, and that's what's making this museum, you know, improving. We've been making a lot of improvements. She and I work together, all, you know, we're equal, you know, sort of, and yet we do our jobs.
What is the role of the museum in Bethel?
Well, it's... mostly the stuff we have, the stuff we carry here at the museum, all the artifacts are from this region. We try to depict things of the past that are now gone and up to present now, which some of them are still, you know, present. So it's our role, preserving the history of this region, Yukon Kuskokwim Delta.
Do you ever bring in exhibits of objects that are not from this region?
We do get some traveling exhibitions, mostly through Alaska State Museum.
What do people here think of the stuff from outside of the area when they come to see it?
Well, people like to see different things. They're always amazed, you know. When we do have stuff like that, we'll, you know, put it in our newsletter or newspaper saying, you know, this exhibition is there. And they like to see different things.
About how many people, say, a day, a week, a month, whatever, do you have coming through?
Let's see. Last year it averaged up to around 20, 23 people a day. During the school year, there's quite a bit of students coming in, touring the museum, and they come from other villages too. And in the summertime, I've seen quite a few fishermen coming in. So it all depends on, you know, who's coming through.
Visitors to the museum walk past the shop to the main exhibit area.
We have some animals here, stuffed animals. they're mostly birds. There's a couple of seals, but one of them is pretty old. There's birds, emperor goose, the black brent bird, and state bird, which is the ptarmigan, and then a couple of canvas back ducks.
Let's talk about this right here is taking up a prominent position in the museum.
Okay. Yeah, this is a temporary display that we have here at the museum. This particular one is the, what we call the old-time moving sled. It's got a sled, two people, a man and a woman, and a couple of dogs standing on each side of the sled. And all the utensils from bowls to bowls and ladles to grass bags to lighting flint and grass woven mats that they used to use a long time ago.
Everything's kind of in miniature.
Yeah, it was meant to be like that, depicting what could have been taken back 100 years ago when people were moving.
Who made this?
This was made by Kay Hendrickson of McCorack. He's now residing in Bethel.
The piece was about 20 inches long. There were several other pieces by Kay Hendrickson in the museum, a miniature ceremonial house dance scene, a mask, and a dance stick, all displayed along with artifacts of hundreds of years past, clothing, tools, utensils, ceremonial objects. And on many of these old things, the colors, the reds and blacks and whites, are much like the colors on the objects made now.
A lot of the good carvers use natural dyes. The red dye is the red ochre. It's found along the coast. It's a porous type of, a clump of rock, but it's really soft. And then the natural dye that they use on the white is the clay, a type of clay. And then, of course, the black they use is the India ink.
Godliva Barr and art director Disa Jacobson encourage area craftspeople to look at old things to see how they're made. India ink is used for the black areas on most of the ivory carvings in the museum, including on two new acquisitions.
One of them is the half-man, half-spirit mask. The appendages around it it's got some animals in it, like the seals. The Harper seal, fox, and the paw of a fox or a wolf.
Why would the museum be interested in these particular carvings?
These particular carvings are unique to this area, and we like to capture some of these carvings and keep them here at the museum for people to see.
Godliva Barr, curator of the Oktarvik Regional Museum in Bethel. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.